Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. From Austin, Texas, I'm the Internet's Christopher Schmidt. And on today's show, I'm joined with Dan Brown, co-founder of H-Shapes, a UX design discovery shop that serves clients in healthcare, education, not-for-profit, and high tech. He's recently authored a book called Practical Design Discovery, published by A Book Apart. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017. Grab your tickets now and learn from Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, Estelle Weil, and many, many more in New Orleans. Tickets are on sale now at cssdevconf.com. Again, that's cssdevconf.com. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Speaking of email, set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, it will be sent straight to your inbox. All you have to do is sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. And of course, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me, the Internet's Christopher Schmidt, on Twitter at Telejct, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, thank you for telling others about Non-Breaking Space. Now, on with the show.
Let me get some camera action here. There we go.
Hey, man. I'm not sure if you remember me at all.
We met at some conference somewhere along the way.
That is a great answer that I'll be using from now on. Whenever someone says something like that to me before. But yeah, we met at Pearson or New Writers when they had a conference in Nashville.
I think. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I remember
we hung out a bit there, but I remember one of my fondest memories in this whole life is wandering around Nashville with Jeremy Keith and Gene Smith.
Yeah.
We just wandered around that conference. That was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's and we were with Aaron Walter and but yeah, we went to the people who do gig posters in Nashville. I forget their name, but they do a whole bunch of country stars and stuff. And then we just wandered around that was a great venue for a great city for a conference. So
yeah.
So yeah.
I haven't been back to Nashville since. So
same here. So but that's a cool thing about the job and everything like that. But yeah, and I think your workshop was the first true workshop that I attended as like a someone in the interactive, you know, industry or web design industry. So, and I was really, really keen on seeing how you would handle a workshop. And so I learned a lot just by watching you handle that workshop.
That's great. That must have been for my first book. Yeah. So
yeah,
that must have been on documentation.
Yeah, I think it was. And you took the time to get to know everyone, which is a lot of people, and I'm not sure you still do that or not, but and just to find out what they wanted to do, what they want to get out of it, which I feel is like a really good thing to do, and basically just check the temperature of the room and get people talking and some of that too. So I thought that's when we met a long time ago, and thanks for taking the time to talk with me today. I guess I just want to get started and ask you what's the greatest challenge facing the digital design industry today, knowing that you've been in the industry for a long time. And how long have you been working in the industry?
I got started shortly after I graduated from college, which was in 1994. Which was right when it was all getting started, so there really wasn't, like, I didn't take any college classes in this stuff. I had just always been a bit of a computer nerd. Yeah. And when computers became a medium in and of themselves, right, when the digital delivery was a thing with the internet, I found that incredibly appealing. And, you know, back in those days, I was a jack of all trades. And I the challenge back then was just, what are we doing, right? Yeah. And then the challenge became, holy moly, everyone is paying attention to what we're doing, so we should get good at it. And I feel fortunate that I've been with the business, been in this industry for long enough to sort of pay attention to design trends. But also, I think what's far more interesting to us is, or far more interesting to me and to watch, is the how we do the work trends. It used to be that you could be one person in a basement building a website that did something cool and interesting and maybe profitable. And now, that is far harder to do. That even if you start out like that, there's far more to web architecture, to marketing, to sales, to all of these things that make a product good. So it needs more people, right? And more people means more challenges. And I think, I've been watching the conversation about inclusivity pretty closely because I feel like this was a conversation that started in the 90s when I was in college. I went to a college that was very politically correct when that wasn't such a bad word. It's been an interesting two decades now, 20 years later, to see those conversations are still happening. And I think they're still there's been a little bit of a breakthrough, right? So I think people are starting to finally hear some of these things, though obviously it's not nearly enough. So what I want to see is, or what I think the biggest challenge is sort of continuing those conversations of how do we make working on the web, being on the web, safe for everybody.
That's a big issue. I mean, even like Ev, who started Twitter and now is at Medium, I think it was a New York Times piece. I hope if I remember that right. Is this, I even said Twitter was great and that we assumed that giving people all voices online would be a good thing. And then now he's, I'm not sure he said he was apologizing for that or whatnot, but he just said hey, that's not how it's going. And so now with Medium, he's trying to, I'm not sure, curate is a word or cultivate is a better word. We're trying to, formulate and promote the voices that are more inclusive, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I do not envy him. I mean, to be sort of the at the focus of a lot of these conversations, in a sense, we've been asking these kinds of questions at least for 200 years, right? For ever since there was a First Amendment, but in many ways longer. What does it mean to be inclusive? What does it mean to give everyone a platform, to give everyone a voice? And what are the ethical considerations around how far that goes? I don't know that anyone. I haven't seen any good answers to those questions. So.
And it's. Yeah, it's a really, just not, yeah, you're right. It's like a slippery slope when you want to say hey, let's give people less freedoms, I guess. I don't know. So, but you still want people to have, engaging dialogue. I'm not really sure. Because one of the things I find that the internet has exposed to me is that, I've been on the web, since 93, it's the same as you, as long as you have. And it just, and I felt like, yeah, we could give people the voice, it'd be great. And it's even challenged some of my notions, I don't want to throw out an idea, but things I've held, everyone surely agrees with XYZ-ish position on this issue. There's it just of course it makes sense that people would, and then you find people who just disagree or say, it depends, or like really? And it really kind of shakes me to a core, we can't really agree on. Right. On fundamentals, and much less what would those fundamentals be. It's just kind of I don't know. I don't know where we're going.
Well, yeah, and I feel the hard part is, I want grownups to show up to those conversations. I they're hard, and I want to have them, and I believe they're healthy, but you also have to sort of be willing to sit and listen, right? You have to be willing to participate. And part of participating means being a little bit vulnerable, being a little bit open to attack, being a little bit okay with being wrong. And, you know, if that's, maybe I've just defined adulthood there, but you know, I think and I don't mean to sound like an old fart here, but I feel like the speed in which things are happening, makes it challenging for people to bring their fully actualized self, right? Their adult version of themselves to the table every time.
Right. And that's, and one of the things I think is also people just don't have the skill sets, or it's really to deal with it. Cause like you go to school or homeschool, you know, maybe homeschool is better for this, but you go to school and they have like, you know, a curriculum, and most of that, it's like hard skills, but like not the soft skills. That, I mean, you get soft skills from I guess, you know, from recess with your peers or hanging out with them. But I feel like at the same time, it's not really taught how to deal with other people, you know. And that's one of the things I like about your game. I'm not sure what your name. I actually researched your game, but I forgot what the name. I forgot what the name of your game is. But I loved your game. I wish you like, you know, talk more about it. But I love the fact that it gave you patterns, what you call patterns, or also like techniques is, you know, kind of a, you don't really use that word, but in terms of how to deal with issues. So if you could just summarize the game that you have there, that's out there.
I love talking about it. I mean, this is sort of why I pay attention to things like inclusivity, because I feel like there are forces at work, right? Tensions that seep into the work that we do and how we work together. And part of the useful, right? Part of those tensions are good. They're healthy. They're productive. By, you know, Chris and I disagreeing on what the design should be, that's ultimately what makes the design better. And I noticed about, I guess it was 5 or 6 years ago now, I noticed that I was having the same situations on projects again and again. Like, I'd been doing it, 10, 15 years by that point. And I felt like even though every project was different and special and fun in its own way, a lot of the situations that I encountered on my very first project, I was still encountering on my 100th project. And those are things like a stakeholder shows up late in the process and provides a lot of design feedback all of a sudden out of nowhere, right? Or a situation like people don't really understand or don't really care what users want, right? They've got their vision for what it is, and they sort of push everything else to the side, or they think they know everything users want, right? So there are these tropes that, as I say them, I'm confident, I'm hopeful that your listeners say, "Oh yeah, that sounds familiar. Oh yeah, that sounds familiar." And I was thinking about them. I started making inventory of them, because that's, you know, I'm an information architect, so I make lists of things, right? So I made this list of all the situations that I encountered, and then I also started making a list of, well, what are some of the techniques that I've heard of or that I use to dislodge, right, to move these situations forward? And that's the patterns that you're talking about, are these kind of starting points that I use to sort of say, okay, you know, they're talking about it in this way. I'm not getting through to them. What's another way I can get through to them? Okay, well, maybe I'll tie it back to a user story, right? Or I'll ask them a question. I'll try and get them to talk more about their perspective, or I'll just simply reflect their perspective back to them. So I have this sort of set of techniques that I almost draw upon automatically, or I've seen my colleagues draw upon, and I wanted to create a way for people to practice these, to learn these. I play a lot of board games with my family, with my friends. And so it was sort of this natural progression to go from, hey, I've got this list of situations and this list of patterns, to how do I pull these together into a gaming session, a way to play a game. So, that's it.
Yeah. So, from my research is like, so it's like a game with problems. Like, so you have a card deck with problems, and then you have another card deck of techniques or patterns. And then you say like, and I assume it's like, so you're given a problem, and then you're supposed to find what type of solutions we can, like, what are patterns we can use to address it? And that's, is that kind of?
Yeah. It's a storytelling game. So if you and I are, I mean, it's better with people, but if we're playing with a group of people, one of the people plays a situation. So this is the first one I drew. This one is called Unreasonable Constraints. And then that person tells a story about how they are in a situation where, you know, one of the stakeholders has provided some really unreasonable constraints, like, you know, it needs to work on my phone, and I need to see both the search results and facets, the sorting facets or the filtering facets. Like, I need to be able to see both at the same time on my handset. You're like, well, that's an unreasonable constraint, right? So now I've told a story. So then the other players around the table have these cards that I call pattern cards, right? And they pick one. They pick one that says that they think would help solve the problem, right? So I've just picked this one. This one is called Set Reasonable Expectations, right? So you might say, all right, I hear you. I hear that you want to try and accomplish that. We're going to put some ideas on the table. I have never seen this done well. I'm setting reasonable expectations. But hey, let's draw some pictures and see what we can get to, right? So the intent is for the players of the game to tell stories about the situations, tell stories about how they would solve the situations in a safe space, right? So you're not doing it in front of your client. You're not doing it with your stakeholders. You're doing it with your team outside the context of a project. So then your team afterwards can talk about what are the different techniques that they used, what was comfortable, what was uncomfortable, what worked, what didn't work, that kind of stuff.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think it's, and people can, I'm gonna buy a deck. So,
please.
Yeah, and people can buy it. We'll have a link in the show notes for people to buy it, but I think it's great.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I think it just goes back to, just bring it back. It's like the reason why we bring it up is just because of the soft skills and getting to know situations and how to counter them. And so that you address them head on and make sure people can, get work done. And have build productive relationships and
that's exactly right. And yeah. And I run sessions of the game at our local General Assembly here in Washington D.C. because they acknowledge that they can teach them all the technical skills that they need to be a user experience designer, but being a UX designer isn't just running a usability test, throwing together a wireframe, right? It's being at the center of a team and working with lots of different people who have lots of different perspectives. Inevitably, conflict comes up. We had gotten it to a point where I would come in following the first group project of the students. So they understood what was at stake, right? They understood or at least had an inkling of the challenges that they would face, because this was probably, for many of them, the first time they had had to work in a collaborative setting, in a group setting like this. And so that the time was right to reflect on it.
Get back to like starting out and versus now and specializing. So like, you said like, in the 90s, it was jack of all trades. And then I guess you started H-Shapes. When did you start that? And was that like when you decided to kind of specialize into design discovery type of things?
No, actually, I had been doing web design for about 10 years. Okay. And I moved, so I got started in North Carolina, okay. In Durham.
Cool.
I met my wife down there, and after living down there for a few years, we got married and decided to move to Washington, D.C. We moved here in 97. And I joined a huge internet consulting company called US Web, which sounds so dated as it comes out of my mouth. after that, I kind of jumped around a little bit to different government contracting gigs, which back then was not sexy, but today is very sexy, or used to be sexy. Anyway, so I was actually at a job at the FCC, and I had met my business partner probably a few years before, and he and I had stayed in regular touch, referring jobs to each other, you know, that kind of thing. And he contacted me and he was like, we should start our own thing. There's nothing like Adaptive Path in the DC area. And that was kind of our model, was Adaptive Path at the time. They had been around since 2001, I think, 2002. And so this was 2006. And, I was very happy in my cushy government contracting job. I mean, it was regular hours. I showed up at 8, I left at 5, no mess, no fuss, right? No craziness. But then my wife got pregnant, and I realized that being chained to my desk for 8 hours a day, there was no sort of work from home flexibility. So 40 hours a week at my desk was not something that I realized how I wanted to spend my life. I was a very risk averse person, but suddenly having a kid made the risk worth it. And so Nathan dragged me. Nathan is my business partner. He dragged me kicking and screaming into this life. And I have not regretted it for a moment. I've loved what he and I have built together over the last 10 years. So.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. And then Nathan it's Nathan Curtis. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
He's doing great stuff on design systems lately.
I mean, he was so far ahead of his time. He wrote a book back in 2009 called Modular Web Design, which was really, if you know Nathan, you know, like, it was deliberate, it was thoughtful, it was considered, it was detailed. It was a fantastic book, but it was, in a sense, not something that people were thinking about at that stage. But I think development frameworks and the institutionalization of design in-house has really made design systems in high demand. And so he's really been at the forefront of this. I mean, he's led now dozens of design systems projects and really just built up an incredible amount of knowledge around not just what is a design system, but what is the organization around it? And how do people need to configure themselves in order to help the design system and ultimately the company at large thrive?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think we had him speak at, I forget which summit it was, but he did just a great job and talk about design systems and everything like that. So yeah, that's, and I feel like, you know, we talk about like being in the web since the 90s, and it just feels like it's a right step, you know, like Nathan, of course, has been there for but it just feels like seeing it go from a page metaphor to a modular, you know, component manager system just seems right. It just seems like, and what they're doing with, you know, design tokens and Storybook now, it seems with React, I just feel like, yeah, that makes so much sense in terms of being able to be flexible and modular. And I don't think we've gotten there without mobile exploding, but yeah, but I just feel like, yeah, this is, it makes sense. I'm not too keen on CSS being my JavaScript, but that's just me. But yeah, I just feel like that seems to be the way about going to. So, but where do you see, you know, maybe you talk with, how do you guys see since the future going from here on out, like in terms of. I know that's a big loaded question. So
yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's lots of ways to I don't know. Can I say skin that cat?
Sure.
I don't actually own any cats, so I'm totally okay with the metaphor. But I know there are cat lovers among us.
So you literally have no skin in the game, I guess. Is
what you're saying. I literally have
no cat skin.
No cat in the game.
Okay.
I just found a new Twitter account that's cats in a sink, and it's all pictures of a cat sitting in a sink, different cats just sitting in different sinks, obviously. But, you know, I didn't think that's why the internet was invented, but here we are.
Yeah.
So, exactly. I don't know. There's a lot of noise and there's a lot of, you know, I feel like I would have a hard time putting into words sort of the trends or the phases that internet development has gone through, internet design, web design has gone through. But I feel like there's sort of periods of turmoil and periods of calm, right? And I feel like we're in one of those periods of turmoil. lots of tools, lots of approaches, lots of questioning what we used to do, right? So I feel like, you know, over the last 5 years, there's been a lot of emphasis on agile philosophies as applied to web design. And now we're starting to see a couple of articles coming out like, hey, maybe this isn't the best way of doing things, right? So there are these moments where we have a new idea and then we start to pull those ideas down, right? And I feel like we're at this moment where some ideas are crescendoing, like design systems, where other ideas we're starting to sort of question them. I feel like what I'm most interested in, what I remain interested in, is the study of how we work together and how we be creative together. And really, creativity is the other side of that. It's the other thing that I'm interested in, is how do we, in fast-moving environments, in highly collaborative environments, in environments where many design problems are already solved, right? That's what a design system is. How do we be our most creative, most innovative selves? I just noticed the guy who wrote that book called Sprint, and one of the guys from Google, is kind of doing a sabbatical at IDEO. He just wrote this little Medium post about it, where he wants to try and discover what creativity is, which, that's awesome. Go for it. I read a bunch of books on creativity in leading up to my last book, Practical Design Discovery. And what I love about the topic is it is so complicated and so hard to unpack, and so many different perspectives that you can have. But my hope, if it's not my prediction anyway, my hope is that we see a lot more of this kind of reflecting on how do we be our most creative selves? How do we bring not just design thinking, but creativity to bear on the work that we're doing? When you were talking about design systems, what I was thinking about is how Nathan's work and my work kind of feed into each other, insofar as Nathan's work on design systems is really trying to set up an infrastructure to help a design team focus on the harder problems, right? And those harder problems are the subject of discovery, right? We spend time researching and thinking about these harder design problems so we know how to solve them, because a lot of other of our design problems, like what a dropdown should look like or how it should behave, those have been solved by the design system.
And then, so I don't want to go back to your latest book, Practical Design Discovery, which is, I guess, your third book, right?
Yeah.
Congratulations on that. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. As a book writer, author, I know those moments should be celebrated very well.
It's getting harder to write a book. It's not getting easier, which was not something I could have predicted, but I don't know if it's because I'm older, I have more to say, or I feel entitled to say more, which may be really what's going on. This was a new publisher, and I got to say, the team at A Book Apart, I never felt more taken care of as an author. I really felt like they were taking care of me as an author, but they were also taking care of the product. And I think we have a much better product because of that. And I'm really proud of this one.
Well, I have to ask, like in what ways do you feel like they took care of you and the material as an author? Because I'm just curious, because I've written several books, and I just want to compare notes, I guess, if you don't mind me talking shop for a second.
Yeah. I mean, this is not to disparage any other publisher or anything out, right? It's just my experience at A Book Apart was what I needed it to be, which is I had one person there that I could talk to, right? And she was always there to take my call, to talk me down, to talk me up, right? To do whatever I needed as an author, right? Because a designer and an author are actually, I feel like I embody two different personalities when I'm these things, right? The author is far more precious, far more emotional, far more dramatic, I guess, melodramatic than the designer in me. And so having someone there who's thinking about the product just as much as I am, but also there to kind of steady me when I needed steadying was great. They also brought some strong editorial support. I was too ambitious with this book, and they they help me be more realistic with the outcome. The thing was probably twice as long, and I've never had to cut so much, and it's never hurt so much to cut so much. But the truth is that the stuff that we cut was not good. It was not my best voice, and I think these guys really helped me find a much better voice. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I just feel like it's one, it's good to know people. I encourage people to write, you know, either it's not a book or just blog per se, but just to realize that, you know, the amount of effort that goes into a production like that, and it's also like making sure you have a good team around you when you do get that opportunity to do it. So cool, awesome. I've never heard nothing, but I've always heard only good things about Book Apart. So
yeah,
in the process,
yeah. So it was great, and they used brown for the cover.
Yeah,
which
I yeah. How do you feel about that?
I asked for it.
Okay.
I
mean,
you know, I had some. There were some favorite colors that my kids had that I was like, oh, maybe I'll use one of their favorite colors. But you know, I realized that was sort of treading in areas that I didn't feel comfortable treading on. So I just went with the visual pun. I feel like it's a dad joke. That's what, you know, I'm just articulating this for the first time, and I feel okay with that.
Okay, so good. Yeah, I must admit, like, I got the preview copy, so I could review it before we talked, and I have a mass of Book Apart books, and I was like, okay, so which one of these small icons is Dan's book? I'm like, oh, it's the brown one.
It's the brown one. It's the brown one.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, the name is pretty useless otherwise. Right. So I figure if it helps with your wayfinding, yeah, then that appeals to the information architect in me too.
Well, to tell you how like it took me like 2 days to figure that out. So I just want you to know.
Okay, fine.
I was like, sorry, I kept clicked a lot of books before I found you. Like, oh, wait. Of course it makes sense. Okay, whatever. but yeah, so your book is about design discovery, and correct me at any point if I'm wrong. This design discovery phase is the phase that you put before building a project or whatever. And like, you know, because usually, like, you know, back in the 90s, especially, you would see like, here's this 4 or 5 point path our web agency will take to build your website. One, we build it. No. So we build it, and then we toss it your way, and then we revise it, and then we launch. And so that was pretty much it. And then we started saying like, no, well, first we add on this this extra phase, the beginning of it, and we'll call this design discovery, and different names for it. But basically, we'll try to figure out what you want to build. And I could never, you know, I think our clients were like, didn't want that a lot of times, but it felt like hard to convince clients that, yeah, we need to figure out what you want built, even though you know you want, you say you want built, but you don't know exactly how you want it built. And so we need to have these conversations. And so a lot of times we would talk to clients back when we had when I was part of a web agency, and they would be hard pressed to spend money to further define what they wanted built. You know, if it was just like, oh, we just need to redesign of our website, go to it. And like, well, no, we need to figure out what it is and whatnot and so that. So, and so that's what I liked about having your book, was that it actually kind of like explores in detail in terms of the process and the importance of it in terms of that. But yeah, so I feel like, I don't have much of a question here. It's just, I feel like, I guess, do you still get like a lot of blowback from clients, or is that just me in my experience? That was just in terms of dealing with clients. So,
you know, it's I've had this question a few times now. And I think there's this misconception. I hope I do a good job of trying to set the record straight, at least a little bit in the book. We've always, I think because of the reason that you mentioned, that we've thought of discovery as a separate thing from design. And I don't think that's a good way of looking at it. I think discovery is a part of design. When you say, I'm going to design something, you're saying, I need to do a little bit of discovery before I can make any decisions about it, right? It's sort of like, a client says to you, come and redesign my website, but don't do any discovery. You can say, okay, right? But as soon as you walk in the door, you're going to ask a question. Well, is this content still important? Or do you want us to touch the navigation, right? In a sense, just by virtue of asking the questions, just by virtue of being curious about what the problem is, you are doing discovery. Because discovery is, in my opinion, clarifying your understanding of the problem and imagining what the solution could be or will be, right? You don't necessarily realize every last little detail, right? That's the other parts of design. But there's a part of design that's sort of making sure that you and I are talking about the same thing. And, you know, in the best cases, you as the client admit, we don't know everything we need. You need to know about this project. So go do some research or go ask some users or go do some prototype testing or something, right? Do something to expand your knowledge, right? That's the best case. Worst case is we're making a lot of assumptions, right? But at least we have a chance to ask those questions. So another question I get is, so do you sell discovery projects? And the truth is I do. I mean, I got to put food on the table. So, but I also feel like there's the demand that I'm seeing in the industry now is we have a room full of designers that are solving lots of our little problems. What we need help with is we've got a big problem that we don't understand and we need your help understanding it, but we just don't want a report at the end. We don't want just you to do a presentation and then leave, right? What we want to do is set ourselves up to build something afterwards. So my discovery work always entails building a little bit and then refining and then building, right? It's the thing that we've heard from the lean UX folks, from, you know, from user-centered all the way back to user-centered design, right? Build a little bit, test it, refine it. This process is really important because I don't feel like we can truly understand a problem until we solve it a little bit, right? Just to go back to creativity, this is what we know about creativity, right? You don't just get an idea in your head, right? You think about the problem space a little bit, you try and solve it a little bit, right? And that's when the ideas, the real ideas start to flow. So that's how I would characterize discovery. I don't know if that changes your impression of it.
I think it's something that needs to be done. And I feel like you're right. Cause you know, I think it's just maybe that I had the wrong clients to be honest. So it's been some years since then. So I'm okay to say that, but they won't like, you're talking about me. Like, no, no, it's just, I feel like, you know, it is part of the project and it just, I feel like, you know, if, and at this point, like, I think I've learned that if a client balks at like a discovery process, you know, maybe, you know, we're not right for each other to run the project, which is like totally a mature human thing to say, you know, just to say, like, okay, cool. That's okay. There's other things I could be working on. So, and,
well, and I'm always curious, like, why? Like, and sometimes the answer is, well, we've done all the research that we need to do, which is fine. The outcome of discovery is not just the knowledge, but the design direction, right? So, and maybe they say, oh, no, we've designed, you know, we've got a set of wireframes already. We just want you to, whatever, design the rest of them or skin them with our style. Or, you know what? That's great. There are college kids or whatever who can do that kind of work, or there are shops that are specialized in that kind of work, but that's not us. That's not what we do.
Right. Exactly. So, and yeah, so that's exactly. So I feel like that's part of the thing. So, so reading the book, I was like, oh, okay, this, and also part of me was also, you know, someone who likes to build things and get started building right away. It was also a nice understanding of what a discovery process looks like, you know, in terms of what the shape is and the tools involved. And, you know, like I talked about the card game earlier, like, oh, that's great. Cause then we can actually find those soft skills to help answer these questions. And also I think that I had the greatest laugh is to, walking through the, problem statements that you have, section, I think it was that project objectives. And so, it was like, what was examples were, Frankensteining was the best one. I think that was the funniest one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just like Frankenstein is like, well, what do you want to build? Like, well, we want to build
a little bit of everything.
Everything of like, you know, a Skype that meets Uber that meets, right. It's like, no. Like, and so, I'm trying to figure out the person who has like the list of them is Steven Anderson. Yeah. So he has like, the problem with problem statements, I believe is what he called it. So, and the other one was like amplifying feedback, which I thought was a great one. So problem statements, I think, you know, like let me know if I'm wrong in terms of, you know, paraphrase. It's just like you want to find out what type of what you want to design, what the solution is going to be. But first, you need to figure out what the problem statement is, like what we're going to solve. And so you talk about forming a correct problem statement, and one of the things you get to that point is to say, like, okay, here's some really bad problem statements and here's a list of the Stephen Emerson said. But the other one that I really liked was amplifying feedback, and that's the one where I think we got five customers that say XYZ is really good or really bad, so therefore this is the problem. And it's like, well, no, we actually need to figure out, like, is the real problem, or there's something underlining to it, and some better.
Those are the only ones who complained, right?
Yeah.
We have a million customers, but those five said that there's something wrong, right? Well, you could say, well, if we extrapolate from that, maybe there's, but I think doing some research to validate those, what you learn there. Yeah. I mean, I think the way I like to characterize a problem statement is, you've got to, audience in mind, and they perceive or they feel like the world is broken for them, or maybe they don't even know that the world is broken for them in some way, right? So the problem statement helps all of us on the team agree on, here's what's broken in the world, for whom, and why that's a bad thing for them. I think coming to that agreement is not sufficient, right? It's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? It's something that's important for me to do so that we all feel like we know what we're trying to do, know why we're here. But at the same time, if I end my discovery just by articulating a problem statement, I haven't done enough. I haven't validated that I feel confident that that problem exists, because problems are things that I can observe, maybe, but they are still sort of things just in our mind, right? Once I start to figure out, once I internalize the problem and start to figure out how I might fix that part of the world, I can validate if this is genuinely a problem for people or not. So I do work for an organization where they come up with a lot of. Actually, let me tell a different story. I was doing some H-Shapes occasionally does some government contracting, and we showed up. We were going to sub to a much larger government integrator, and my colleague James and I showed up to this meeting, and they were like, "So we already designed the dashboard that these government people are gonna want." And James and I started asking a lot of questions about it. And what was clear, this is sometimes how things work in the government, where they sort of, in order to get the funding, they need to show you what they're going to build, even though they don't really know what they should build, right? And as we were asking questions, it was abundantly clear that they had made a lot of assumptions, but maybe this part of the world wasn't really broken, right? Maybe there wasn't a real need here. They hadn't identified that there was a real need there. So... I feel like one of the things that discovery helps with is, I think this part of the world is broken. Let's start to solve it a little bit. And that helps us really understand what that means.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if I can say, like, just in terms of that, it just clarifies in you the mystery of the problem. Like, so is this really the problem, like you said before? It's like, or is it something else that's really broken? And so I feel like it's pretty good. And so, and another part is like the double diamond diagram, which I'd never seen before. But, you know, Peter Maholtz, I think is famous. It came up with. I'd never seen that before, and I follow Peter pretty good, but I missed that one.
Wow!
So yeah.
he talks about that one a lot.
Yeah, I think I pretty much missed that one completely. So, but yeah, but in terms of the discovery phase and everything, I felt like, oh, okay, this is how, so it's a book. I think people should pick it up if you're not even who would be part of the phase, which I kind of weird, but I think if everyone who's involved in the web or building apps should pick up the design discovery book, because I feel like it helps clarify a lot of issues. And for me, you know, someone who's a coder, who's journalist, I think journalist from the 90s and wants to understand like how to put the best face forward into solving projects, I think this is a really great book. So really,
thanks. I mean, what I was trying to do was be as process agnostic as I could be. So the book doesn't say these are the exact steps you need to follow to do discovery. What I do is I give you sort of four categories of things that one does in discovery, everything from gathering information all the way to planning, what the solution is. So there are these four things, and I see them as dials that I can turn, right? And depending on my circumstance, I might have only, you know, one day to do all four things, right? Because I'm in that kind of environment. Well, I can turn those dials down to one and still do a little bit of discovery just to build up my confidence in the decisions that I need to make later.
Right. And I think in this world today, like, you need to have as much, evidence, if you will, data or, and to be able to understand and read the data that make sure that you're on the right path. I think that's is so important in this day and age. Like, I think it's kind of a sin if you don't have it, if I may say so, like, if you don't have that research to back up your design directions. But I still see a lot of people like, just like, I'll just build it. And, okay, well, that's cool if it's your project, but like a hobby, but you may want to, even then you still want to like test things out and make sure you're building it. But if you just want to see it, just see if it works, that's cool. But yeah, cool. So I think it kind of comes to the point. I think you said hopefully I got this right, but so the hardest part of design isn't doing the design, but it's the people. Is that right? Is that that phrase?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I wrote a book. My second book is called Designing Together, which is all about collaboration and conflict. And right. That was sort of the thrust of the book is let's talk about design, but not how to do design, but how to work with everyone on the project. Yeah.
So I think this is, I'm just here. I hate to be shameless, blow so much smoke about there, but I just felt like it's a great book, Design Discovery, and the game, card game looks awesome in terms of helping people with the social skills, the soft skills, if you will, to solve the problem. I really, glad I took the time to read the book and talk to you today. So it's really great. I probably will have you back on later just to answer more questions as I go through the material.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's great. But how can people find you and find the books online if they want to ask you any questions or not? How can they get?
Sure. I love talking shop. So I love talking about collaboration or discovery. Twitter is, I spend way too much time on there for a middle-aged white man, but I am Brownorama on Twitter. I have Medium articles under that username as well. Eight Shapes has a little publication up on Medium that we, both Nathan and I, post a lot to. So that's where I'm at.
Cool. And where can people get the board game or the card game? Sorry.
Yeah, actually, if you go to greenonions.com, that's my personal domain. I've actually got a Medium publication attached to that, and that's got listings for all my books and the card game, Surviving Design Projects.
Okay, cool. Cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time today and have a great weekend.
So. Yeah, it was great catching up with you, Chris. Thanks so much.